Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. I'm Brian Kiley. On today's episode, I'm joined by Bridgeway pastors Lance Hahn, Judah Sanders, and Josh Ute to talk about the tragic assassination of Charlie Kirk and its aftermath. We'll discuss the horror of political violence, what this crime and its aftermath show us about the state of politics, how we can resist the divisiveness of our culture, and how we can show Christ-like compassion to those we disagree with. All that and more in this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hi everyone, thanks for joining us for this episode. I said to my wife before I left the house today, of all the hundreds of podcasts I've ever recorded, I don't know that I've ever been less excited to talk about a topic than this one, joined by Pastor Judah. Judah, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Pastor Josh.
Hello, hello.
And Pastor Lance.
Yeah, I'm here too.
Appreciate you taking the time to join us today, Lance. Of course, all of you know by now, last week, conservative activist Charlie Kirk was assassinated during a public event on the campus of Utah Valley University. Kirk was an unashamed follower of Jesus Christ. He was a man made in the image of God. He was 31 years old with a wife and two children. He's the founder of the political organization Turning Point USA and was known for hosting events on college campuses where he would invite those who disagreed with him to debate him. And it was at one such event that an assassin ended his life. And gentlemen, I remember when I heard the news that he had died, it felt like my stomach just fell out of my body. I was in complete disbelief and my mind just went all over the place. I thought about this man's wife and kids first and foremost, and the cruelty of them losing their husband and father and all of the memories that were stolen from him. I thought about the horror of a person being killed for their beliefs. We are a nation built on free speech and the respectful exchange of ideas. I agree with one political commentator this week who wrote, "We have to be able to see the bullet that tore into him as an attack against us all." Charlie Kirk was out on campus among people who disagreed with him, inviting conversation, and that is an honorable thing. And it is certainly true that an attack on someone doing that is an attack against all of us and must be condemned in the strongest possible terms. Lance, we'll start with you. What are some of your thoughts as you've processed this tragedy this week?
Yeah, if I'm going to talk about kind of initial reactions to it, I was immediately saddened, but I was not surprised. And the reason why I say that is that I've had to live in a world where I have a security team. I have to live in a world where I'm on the radio. I'm out there in public view. And the idea of threat is constant. And I believe that Charlie Kirk knew also the danger very, very well. And so the surprise factor was not there. The hurt factor was there because almost immediately after I heard the news, I saw a video of his little kids running up to him. There's a pretty popular video that's going out that kind of shows him driving up at home with his truck and the kids all excited that he got home.
Yeah.
And so for me as a dad, yeah, as a husband,
yeah,
and then of course, as an intellectual person, the way I process, I immediately went into ramifications of going, here is a personal tragedy that takes us out. And then, oh my goodness, this means greater pain. That was kind of my response.
Yeah. Josh, how about you?
My initial response was a little bit of confusion about it, to be honest. I've heard his name. I don't know Charlie Kirk's political views until this incident, obviously. And so I was more surprised and confused of what was going on and what was happening. The only things I had heard about him at that point was that he was having public debates. I'm a giant free speech activist. Like, I would love there to be no censorship and just allow bad ideas the light of day and people to talk about bad ideas, because the protection of bad ideas gives us protection for the good ideas and for the gospel. Like, I really feel like that's an important part and foundational piece of who we are as Americans. And to think that that was the cause of the death, yeah, of someone is incredibly troubling.
Yeah.
And so I'm just very sad, honestly. It's very sad that that's the state of American politics at the moment. and that this, you know, shootings, gun violence have just become way too common.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be a pathway forward. It's this social contagion that is, it is acceptable to shoot someone you disagree with.
Yeah.
And it's awful.
Yeah, it really is. Judah, how about you?
Yeah, I too was just rocked by it. I have had the privilege of traveling to many countries and seeing the state and condition of those countries when political violence is the norm. And so for me, it doesn't matter a whole lot who it is. I don't want to live in a world and in a country where people are murdered, really for any reason, but certainly over their ideas, you know, regardless of what those ideas are. And I remember when it first happened, just really hoping that that Charlie Kirk didn't die.
Yeah.
That's what I was, my immediate thought was, I really hope that at the end of his, the story isn't that he was murdered, because the consequences and the ramifications of that and the ways that these sorts of situations inflame, it was deeply troubling to me.
Yeah. I mean, really, you think about in terms of prominent political figures in the United States, you'd have to go back to Bobby Kennedy in 1968, his assassination, to go a public figure of this weight, of this magnitude. And yes, the collective national trauma of that. And my goodness, we have it on video, a video that I regret watching and am struggling to get out of my head. It is... the trauma's deep, and we've obviously seen that expressed in a lot of different ways this week.
Yeah, and when there's the attempted assassination of President Trump on the campaign trail, I would have hoped that a failed assassination attempt would have been enough to wake us up.
Totally.
And I think that's also part of the grief, is that we have seen this coming in different ways of different political figures being murdered, some assassinations, as we'll talk about in a minute, but there's more than just this one incident that is like, there's a social piece here that is deeply grieving.
Yeah. The aftermath, Lance, sparked a lot of very intense reactions from people. Aside from a few whack jobs, pretty much everybody across the ideological spectrum was, of course, condemning the event, condemning the murder, grieving just the horrific loss of life of this individual. But then there was sort of a next level of grief that was really different across different ideologies. And it highlighted this reality that for many of us, we think we're living in the same world with everyone else, but we're actually not. What does that mean?
Yeah, we have our self-designed realities, which tends to be exacerbated by echo chambers, algorithms, things that keep giving us reaffirming that we're seeing the world a certain way. So where this got highlighted in this particular incident was that Charlie Kirk was a public persona that was filmed and recorded a lot. So he was on podcasts, he was on news shows, he was, a lot of his debate elements were all over the news. And I had people coming to me saying rather extreme views of him either being larger than life good or larger than life bad. And they were all citing videos and evidence. Mm-hmm. It was really weird.
And this was, I would imagine, maybe Christians and non-Christians, but there were Christians on both sides of
on
that.
On both sides.
Right.
And they were coming to the table saying, and this is why. So it wasn't just, I have an opinion. They were literally citing things that were coming to them and said, I have video evidence he is X or he is Y, yeah. Which means they were living in completely different realities. Same guy had two different worlds going on, meaning in people's minds.
Yeah.
So he was consistent in who he was, but mm-hmm. how people were interacting with his material was dramatically tailored to their viewpoints. And it's not to say that because really to get to any type of truth, you're going to actually have to dig something out as opposed to it coming and being delivered to your box.
Yeah.
And most people interacted with Charlie Kirk with what was delivered to them as opposed to going and finding. And that allowed very much of a disparate perspective on, oh, he was mostly known for this. And you go, that's really interesting because someone else just said he was mostly known for that. And that's what I mean. I just feel like everything is so individualized in our world today that we could be walking down the street and we're completely interacting with a different world of our minds.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think it takes a real high level of self-reflection to recognize that, because I catch myself even thinking, yes, you know, oh, these things that I believe or these things that I understand about the world. Yeah, we all sort of get this and we all agree on these things. And the truth is that's not the case. And the truth is probably a lot of even my convictions are formed by opinion type stuff, are formed by algorithm more than objective reality. And I say that as someone who fights really hard against
me
that.
Too.
But we live in these different worlds.
So how much of that is based on social media algorithm stuff now versus back in the 70s where we had three news stations and that was it? And that we all got our news from kind of the same place. And we have five major newspapers. Like, how much of that is built into social media?
What makes me laugh about that, and not to say that anything is funny right now in this, but what makes me kind of laugh is we all got lied to at the same time in the same way. But like back in the day, there were still distortions.
Totally.
In the news, but everybody was hearing the same information, as opposed to now, everything, you're hearing different perspectives and lies about the same thing in a bunch of different areas. And so that's what was weird back in the day where there's only three channels. Yeah. Hey, I heard what Cronkite said. You heard what Cronkite said. Everybody heard what he said. Whether it was right or wrong, we were at least interacting together.
Yeah. And there were not nearly the incentives to go after people, to kind of build a platform based on what you're against and those types of things. But I think, you know, Lance, returning to this idea of we're living in two different worlds or many different worlds, we obviously experienced some of the challenge of that with some online activity this week.
Yeah. So within our own church, our own staff, we have a varied group of opinions on a lot of different issues. And in my opinion, as the senior leader of this church, that is intentional. We have intentionally built into our church an allowance for differing opinions. And that is something that I'm always going to fight for. I'm always going to push for. Yeah. But in situations like this, what ends up happening is that you have people sitting next to each other in the proverbial pew that have polar opposite passions or perspectives. And when we begin to post those out, taken out of context from that own person's mind, because a post is never the full story. When you see something online, it triggers from your context personally, and you react and interact to it maybe different than it was intended by the author. And what we found was we even had all these people that love each other inflamed by each other's response, right? So while we're in this room, right, we obviously have Pastor Judah here. And Pastor Judah, you ended up on your personal socials sharing some perspectives that absolutely made sense in your context, and there was a tremendous reaction to that. So can you share a bit on that?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. And thank you to all of the folks who have reached out to me, whether they agreed or disagreed and been willing to have conversations. I think that that is hard to do in this kind of climate. I'm really encouraged that there are many people in our community and church space who are willing to do that. When Charlie Kirk was murdered, I was online, which is always a bad idea when something tragic happens. But I have a very, very diverse community in my life. And I have a lot of relationships with communities that are often seen as opposing communities, communities of folks that often I am the one who has friends in whatever that group is, right? And I was noticing that there were two extremes that felt very loud to me and very concerning to me in how people were responding. On the one hand, I saw people being extraordinarily cruel about his murder, celebrating his death, saying things that were just, for me, just unacceptable, just nasty when somebody has died. And I think when people die, we ought mourn. You know, it really doesn't matter who they are. When people die, we ought mourn. And particularly when people die in these kinds of grotesque, violent, and nationally impactful ways, we ought mourn. I think a lot about Charlie Kirk's children, because, you know, his children aren't waking up today thinking that there's a political activist who's no longer with us. His children are waking up without a father. And so I saw that on the one hand. And on the other hand, I saw a lot of people who are believers or evangelicals that were glorifying him, almost deifying him in this way that concerned me, because what I know is that there are a lot of communities who have experienced Charlie Kirk in a different way than the evangelical church, and evangelical Christians, many have. And I was thinking about, you know, how many people that I know who look at the church and have this narrative that churches, particularly evangelical churches, are you know, kind of these mean, aggressive places full of bias, and, you know, where only certain kinds of people are safe. And I was seeing the posts from, you know, evangelical Christians about him, and worried about how that might impact our witness, that might further the narrative that only a certain type of person is safe, that you're only safe in the church if you have a particular politic, if you look a particular way, if you're in a certain tax bracket. And so I'm seeing these two extremes and feeling maybe even arrogantly like I was the one who could speak to it, because I live in the in-between space a lot. And so I attempted to craft a statement that acknowledged both of those things, that acknowledged that we ought mourn for Charlie Kirk and for his children and for those who loved him and for our country, who, as you were speaking about, Pastor Brian, have just witnessed something that is nationally traumatic. I don't know why Instagram left that video up. It's insane to me. I text my mom and was like, "Hey, take the kids' iPads. Like, there is no social media today because this is on Instagram." And so I wanted to acknowledge that, and I wanted to call people into account for being gracious, even though Charlie Kirk had a complicated legacy in life that people engaged with in different ways. I wanted my friends who were not necessarily evangelicals and not necessarily big fans of Charlie Kirk to lean into compassion and to lean into kindness, not just for the sake of Charlie Kirk and his family, but for the sake of our own hearts, right? That we have to not protect ourselves from shared pain with other people, right? And we see this modeled by Jesus. Shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept in response to his friends being sad. He knew how he was going to solve the problem, but his friends were sad, so he was sad. So I wanted to say that. And I also wanted to encourage people to hold space for the folks who engaged and experienced Charlie Kirk in a way that was different from them, right? People who just had trouble with things that he said, with ideas that he promoted, and who were really struggling. And it was important to me, again, because of the church's witness, because of our witness, because we have to be intentional about pushing back against the narrative that the church is an exclusive place, when really it is an inclusive place. Whoever so believeth in him shall have everlasting life. And so I crafted this statement, and I think in my pride, I just thought it was a well-done statement. I thought it was nuanced and balanced. I thought that it really was kind of a both sides are valid, both experiences matter, that multiple things can be true simultaneously, right? That there are people, for us in this very room, I think that there are probably people who would sing our praises, who would say, oh, you know, you're fantastic preachers, you're wonderful humans. And there are also people who would probably have a different perspective. And that we don't, especially in a moment of tragedy and grief, that it's critical to hold both of those perspectives. And unfortunately, the statement didn't land well. It hurt people. It scared people. It offended people. It disappointed people. And then there began to be responses. And so we have spent the last probably 48 hours really thinking through and praying through, what does this mean, right? What is there to learn? Certainly for me as an individual, what should I learn? What is there to learn about things like timing? I think what is there for us to learn corporately about what lives beneath the surface in our hearts, right? And I think that tragedy does this great job of like pulling to the surface what has been simmering beneath. And so I've been spending a lot of time in reflection, but also in conversation. And some of those conversations have been deeply meaningful and have made me very proud, right, to see people be able to have hard conversations where they deeply disagree and where they're hurt, right? Because there's disagreement, but disagreement that is seasoned by hurt, yes, is a different thing, yeah, right? I want to say to anybody that is in that camp that felt hurt by the post, that felt disappointed, that even feel angry, I hear you. I am unpacking and processing how I have contributed to the hurt of others. And because that's not my intention, I want to full-throated apologize for that pain. And, you know, what I really hope is that we are able to model as Bridgeway for a wider community, that we actually really can be successful in this really insane experiment called diversity. It's actually insane to try to put a bunch of people who look different, vote different, are in different economic tax brackets, have very different experiences in the same place and tell them to do life together. And I think kind of with that comes moments like these where there are opportunities for conversation and for learning and for healing. And if there's anybody who would like to chat about this, I would love to get a cup of coffee or gin, depending, and talk about this, because I believe that that is the fruit that could be good out of a quite awful situation, that we could actually, there could be a deepening of relationship and of example. And I am open to talk with anybody who would be open to that.
One thing I wanted to share before we move on is it highlights something that even with brilliance and even with the best intentions in the world, social media is a very tricky animal. Yeah. And I don't know a lot of more thoughtful wordsmiths than Pastor Judah. I don't know a lot of people that could, because everyone's coming to their computer or their phone and they're saying, they know what I mean.
Yeah.
Or they're saying, I'm the balanced one amongst my friends. And the minute it goes out, the interaction with it may not match your intention. And even with the best of us, even though we're the most eloquent of us, and even though we have good hearts.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And I think we learned a painful lesson in that this week. God knows I've certainly made mistakes in the past with things I've posted to social media that were really not helpful. And even if I didn't intend harm, they certainly caused harm. And I've had to, you know, go back and clean up and apologize. And, you know, Pastor Judah, one thing I appreciate about you so much is if somebody has a problem with you, you want to talk to them. And if you've got a problem with someone else, you want to talk to them. And yeah, we've had a lot of conversations about the post, how it probably wasn't a good idea, how the timing was rough and all of that. But you haven't shied away from it. You've welcomed conversation. You all in this room know I have a real problem with folks having a problem with a person and then going and complaining to their boss instead of going to them directly. And mm-hmm. I think if we've had people come and complain to us and instead of talking to you, and every person who's talked to you, you've had a willingness to engage with them and you've reflected and you've had a willingness to learn from this and move forward and get better. And God knows Bridgeway Christian Church is a place where we are allowed to make mistakes. Every single one of us in this room has made many of them.
100%.
I think we take turns helping pull each other off the mat from the mistakes we make, and we learn from it. There's grace for one another. There's grace for those we disagree with, and we move forward.
Amen.
We'll be right back. Well, we are back, and what makes Charlie Kirk's assassination even more troubling is that it is one of many acts of politically motivated violence in our country in the last few years. One study showed that there have been over 2,000 threats of violence made against elected officials since 2022. There have been well-publicized incidents, such as the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband in 2022 from a man saying he wanted to kidnap Nancy and break her kneecaps. In that incident, he severely injured her husband, 82 years old, with a hammer. In 2024, there was the aforementioned assassination attempt on the president where he was wounded. Earlier this year, an arsonist attempted to burn down the house of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. A gunman fired 180 shots into the CDC in Atlanta, tragically killing a police officer. A gunman posing as a police officer murdered Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman earlier this year. And a poll conducted in April with over 1,200 respondents from across the political spectrum revealed that 38% of people said that it would be somewhat justified to murder the president. And it's important to note, they broke down who said what. It was not all of those people were on the left. There were even some on the right. So it is deeply, deeply troubling. And to interject one more thing, I don't talk about my brother publicly for a lot of reasons, and I don't really listen to what my brother says publicly. I prefer to keep him as my brother. For those who don't know, he is a member of Congress. And I want to be able to say I have no idea what's going on when people want to talk to me about his political activity. But he's my brother. Yeah. So this is deeply personal to me. Yeah. And it is deeply personal to my parents that we have to worry about his safety and his security. So right, left, whatever, we just gave examples of politicians on both sides of the aisle. It's unacceptable. And two things about this are clear to me. One, many in society have made politics our God. And when your God is politics, it can drive you to do some truly awful things. Second, political extremism and violence is a major problem on all sides of the political divide. So my question, and we'll start with you, Lance, why are we so inclined to make a God out of our political views?
I think that there's a noble reason, misguided, and I think that there is a fleshly, sinful reason why we do that. The noble reason is that when we see something that is wrong, there's a sense of justice that kicks up in us that says, this must be made right. Other people are ignoring it. I must be the champion of it, and I'm going to dig in my heels. So in a sense, how we carry that out, but we allow our opinions of justice, our view of justice, to propel us into making it bigger than it is, and it becomes a God in our life. I think that's a noble reason. It's just misguided, and it leads to damage.
Yeah.
The sinful reason is that we like being right. And that spirit inside our hearts that says, you got to be right. It's about you. Your perspective's always right. I think that whisper of Satan saying you're your own God, that ever since the Garden of Eden all the way till now, I think that political purposes, political ideologies, political things put us into camps of being right and wrong. And that means we can advance and we can become aggressive about that because it stirs up our feeling of dominance, superiority, things like that. I think that is a sinful element.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want to be right in all the things that we know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not a bad thing for us to seek to have right thoughts and for us to do right things. But then we begin to project that onto other people without the compassion for one another of differing opinions. And we begin to seek answers and place our hope in human beings. And politics becomes our God because we can touch it and we feel like there's instant hope that this new politician or this new thing is going to bring, or there's complete worry that when this thing falls apart, that, oh, this wasn't my person and now everything's going to hell. And like, yeah, you know, this idea that all of our hope is being placed in politics because we've been taught by the world that politics drives the quality of our life.
Yeah.
And so because we believe that politics drives the quality of our life, it's incredibly easy to make that our God. And so we make idols out of politicians who represent quality of life for a lot of people. Yeah. That is not just opportunity. It's not just an idea. It's not an ideology. It is my life will succeed or fail based on who's in office. Yeah. And I'm worried that my life will be dramatically poorer in every sense of that word if the wrong person is in office. And so that's super easy to then place all of our hope into whoever's in that position.
And if you really believe that, kind of anything becomes justifiable in defense of your own
100%.
Views, right. Yeah. Judah, anything you want to add?
I mean, I think on a basic level, born in sin and shaped in iniquity, I think that we have a sinful nature and a proclivity toward idolatry. Proclivity attaches itself to all kinds of things, usually the things that are right in front of us. And in this digital age, what is right in front of us almost always is something political. And when we say political, there are kind of two different things that means, because politics is the organizing of society, right? And so in some ways, everything is political, but there is a real challenge with like not seeing a bunch of political inflammatory stuff all the time.
Yeah.
If you just have a cell phone, you don't even have to have like an Instagram or a TikTok. If you just have a cell phone,
yeah,
it's, I think, really hard to navigate. And so I think that a combination of our sin nature and then also our current culture and our access to people, to information, and the ability to communicate about that information is just really different today than it's ever been.
Yeah.
And that feels like the perfect storm for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to add one more piece. And I think it happened with the assassin of Charlie Kirk. And that is when our ideas about something that could be qualified as political become an ideology to an identity. When we shift over into an identity, then it is no longer we're arguing ideas. Yeah. You're arguing the quality of my existence.
Yeah.
And you're arguing the whole of me. And therefore, everything is taken personal.
Yeah. And that is really a big part of what's behind, you all know and our listeners know, like I'm really not a fan of political parties at all. And I really discourage anybody who wants to follow Jesus Christ from identifying with a political party. And that has actually very little to do with actual beliefs about right. what would be qualified as, say, classical conservative beliefs or classic liberal beliefs. You want to go ahead and have beliefs in those areas? That's fine. Like, yeah, whatever. I've got them too. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. No. What has happened is politics is actually no longer about beliefs. It has become this all-encompassing identity marker. And I think that's part of why it's like the response to this tragedy is not just people with different opinions about a guy processing their grief in different ways. It is so many people feeling personally attacked by the manner in which people viewed this individual. And I, you know, this was so interesting to me. I was listening the other day to an interview between Ezra Klein and Ben Shapiro, who Ezra Klein is a liberal. He writes for the New York Times. And I appreciate the fact that he is pretty thoughtful and that he oftentimes is critical of his own side in terms of like, how do we actually do things that are help, that help people? And Ben Shapiro is like, he is a conservative, like an actual conservative in terms of like, he believes conservative ideas and he advocates for them. And anytime, and I just like heard they were in conversation, and anytime I see people on opposite sides, like having a long form conversation, that's not like some gotcha debate, like I'm interested. And I thought it was so interesting that Ben Shapiro readily admitted, like it was the most normal thing in the world, that, oh yeah, the right is about opposing the left. And he tried and made the argument that the left is about opposing the right. That he actually made the argument that the political right is post-ideological, that it's not even about ideas anymore. It is about, he didn't use the word hating, but it is about hating
beating
the left, right?
Beating the
and again, made the argument that the left is about hating the right. And they went back and forth, kind of Ezra challenged him on some of that. And I just kind of go, I am not comfortable aligning myself with an organization whose chief end is to oppose those guys. Cause I just don't see how, like, if I want to be a person of meekness, if I want to be a person who loves my enemies, that sort of ideology in the sense that, hey, we're about hating other people and about destroying other people. That's tough, man.
Yeah, and I think it's what has happened that we've turned politics into a form of entertainment in a lot of ways.
Yeah, gamified
it. And so because of that, it's my jersey versus that jersey, and the people don't matter. The ideas don't matter as long as my jersey wins.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an advocate for my sports teams. You know, that the teams that I'm into, I want them to win at all costs. And even if they cheat a little, but they still get away with it, Astro fans, it still will. I can't let it go. You know, even if they cheat, like it's fine as long as my team wins. When it's something as superficial as sports, like whatever.
Yeah.
But we are dealing with people's lives.
Yeah.
And so this idea that we are being drawn into a worship of a political party because we're placing our hope there, we're placing our dreams there, we're placing all of our importance, all of our identity there, that's where this thing gets really ugly really fast and becomes incredibly difficult to separate ourselves from.
Yeah, no, that's
and to
true.
Separate our theology from.
Absolutely.
Totally. And the melding of theology with politics is obviously problematic as well. Now, there's a strong inclination from those in politics to blame the other side when acts of violence occurred. And a notable exception to this, I want to give some credit to Republican Governor Spencer Cox from Utah, who I think has led very, very well through a lot of this tragedy. And I want to just read a quote from him. He said, "We can return violence with violence. We can return hate with hate. And that's the problem with political violence. It metastasizes because we can always point the finger at the other side. And at some point we have to find an off ramp or it's going to get much, much worse. But see, these are choices we can make. History will dictate if this is a turning point for our country, but every single one of us gets to choose right now if it's a turning point for us. We can make decisions." Why is it that there is this such strong inclination from those who are politically involved to blame the other side as fast as possible, and why is that a problem?
Yeah, who wants to take that one?
Not it.
We'll edit this, obviously.
It's a lot easier to blame somebody else than it is to self-reflect. I'm dealing with this with my daughter, who decided that this morning was the right time to do all of her homework instead of last night when she watched hours of TV because I was at work and my wife was at a rehearsal. And she blamed us.
It was a good night.
It was a good night. But she blamed us for these instances. And so I had to bring some pretty strong correction. You know, it was gentle in delivery, but it was very, very direct of, do not blame somebody else for your choices.
Yeah.
You made some choices and you're going to have to live with those choices. And I realize that that stinks now, but Like, you made that. It's way easier for us to look at the other side and blame them than it is for us to look at the choices that we've made that led to our own results.
Yeah. I also think it has to do with self-justification. Mm-hmm. If somebody else cuts me off, they did it intentionally. If I did it, I was having a bad day and I just happened to not see them and my mind was busy.
Yeah.
So I think the excuse of in our own world versus they did it intentionally, they did it wrong. So we automatically do not give them the grace that we give our own team.
Right. Yeah.
I also think that there is this binary that we live in culturally that I don't really subscribe to. And it's this binary of good people and bad people.
Yeah.
And like my experience has been, they just really aren't good people. Right. Like people are complex and complicated and under 100%. The right circumstances, the best of people that were under the right circumstances, Mother Teresa could do a terrible thing. Yeah. And so I think that we don't hold enough space and give ourselves even permission to be complex and to be layered and then to be able to look at those things in ourselves. I think that that's just not a muscle that we're very that's very developed in us.
I think something that's been super discouraging for me in this last week, I was talking to a colleague of ours, just appreciating letting her know I appreciated, you know, some of what she shared during a staff discussion. And I said, you know, quick, name a public figure who's amassed a huge following by giving nuanced solutions to public policy problems and self-reflecting on how they might be contributing to the problems in society. And of course, you know, it's a joke. Nobody has. Right. And everything in politics is about leveraging what happened to gain something for my side, right? Somebody on my side commits an act of violence against the other side. Oh my gosh, everybody look out. The other side's going to try to use this to stifle free speech. They're going to try to go after us. Oh my gosh, we better stop. Somebody commits an act of violence against my side. They did this. We tried to be good people and they attacked us for it. It is, this sort of thing is being encouraged all the time. And it is just incredibly toxic. And I've talked on this show before about the problem of incentives. There is so much incentive for bad actors to fan the flames of division and for bad actors to give us reason to keep hating each other because it gets them clicks and followers and money and power.
I do want to say, because I think that in moments like these, I know the temptation for me has been to want to pull away from politics, absolutely. Just, I don't want to read it. I don't want to see it. And I don't think that that's the correct answer. One, because, you know, decisions are going to be made with or without you, and they're going to impact, you know, your lives. And I think that some of the forces that are not so healthy, that are shaping our politics and moving our politics, really benefit from balanced, decent folks, you know, logical and, you know, just kind of the best of us tapping out. And so I think, you know, there's this show called and this book called The Wheel of Time. And in it is a people group that they say they practice the way of the leaf, which is they forswear violence, right? They just don't. If somebody's attacking them, they just won't fight back. They'll run if they can. And if they can't, then they, you know, they endure. And there's a quote in the book. And the lady says, the only way that that violence will end is if everybody everywhere stops. And I think in the same way that the only way that our political systems, our political discussions, our political functions will get better is if we just all decide that we're just not participating like this, that we're not going to do that. And that seems, I feel like that seems like big and far and aspirational and not possible. But again, the history of our country says that we are actually good at doing really big, hard, aspirational things that in the moment seem impossible. But when enough people get on board and say, you know what, we're not doing political violence. And you know what, we're not even doing political verbal violence when we talk to each other and about each other. And you know what, we're not going to continue to support the incentivizing of this way of doing politics. We're going to build something different. I just think that that's possible. And I think I don't want anybody to hear all of this and think, well, you know what, I'm just going to turn off the TV and I'm just going to not participate, because we actually need your voices in the space in order to make it better.
That's absolutely right. Last thing for this segment. So easy to blame. But in so many areas of life, and certainly in these big cultural moments like this, it's so critical that we resist the urge to exclusively find fault apart from us, people that look different than us, act different than us, have different beliefs than we do. Why is developing the ability to look in the mirror and consider how we might be part of the problem so crucial if we're going to get through tense moments like this?
This ties into something that was heavy on my heart. I believe that we are under, and when I say we, I mean we, are under some pretty intense self-delusion. And what I mean by that is once we start operating in justifications and it's them, not us, actual wisdom, common sense goes out the window. And let me give you an example. And I was just looking this up last night. So I was trying to look at, do they now have a motive for the assassin of Charlie Kirk?
Yeah.
And the New York Times and Fox News both published, which of course they do not see eye to eye, but both published this, their current status of what they think the assassin did. And he said, I committed this violence to stop hate. And he went, wait, I'm sorry. Did you just say you killed someone because you're responding to hate?
Yikes.
And you go, so you did hate with hate. That's when common sense has now gone out the window.
Yeah.
Because you're now saying, because I can do things they can't do, I'm doing it different than they are because they're a different sort. When we have, and I think this is what Pastor Judah was talking about, when we start to begin thinking collectively in the mirror and saying, first of all, where am I part of the problem? Yeah. Second of all, we are all worse for this. Like, it's ruining everybody's lives.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not making anybody better. Right. It didn't just hurt the other team that you're looking at. Yeah. It hurt you. And it's that whole, you know, cut off your nose to spite your face kind of attitude.
Yeah.
Common sense out of self-delusion says, I can do things differently than everybody else, but when they do it, I can blame them.
Yeah. And that just gets us, nowhere, right? So I think there's an element in which I think our faith would, I mean, my goodness, the words of Jesus, like look at the log in your own eye, that our faith would teach us a different way, that we would say, before I'm concerned with people whose ideologies are different than mine, and there's room for that. I'm concerned about people whose ideologies are different than mine. I'm not blaming them for all the problems in society. I think there's plenty of blame for that to go around. But the problems I want to be most concerned about are not the problems I see in people I don't relate to and I don't vote for and I don't, you know, connect with. I want to be most concerned about the problems that are caused by me personally and by people like me. Because if all of us are looking in the mirror and saying, how can I actually be part of the solution? That can actually help us create a more peaceful, just, kind, dare I say, Christ-like world. We'll be right back. So in the last segment, we talked about the importance of just looking in the mirror in these really, really tragic moments to go, okay, how in any regard are people like us contributing to these problems that we see in society that then these tragic events highlight just how far they can go? And I think there have been a lot of folks on various opinions and different things who have really tried to process this in a very mature and healthy manner, trying to just process their grief, trying to process, oh my gosh, I saw this guy differently than some others. But inevitably, I think situations like this also stir up that there are a lot of us, even followers of Christ, who just show a really extraordinary lack of compassion for people that we disagree with. So what we want to close the episode with is just talking about, how can we get better at this? How can we learn to disagree better, as the governor of Utah encourages to do? And how can we be people who show Christ-like compassion to those that think differently than us? And Josh, can you just say something to us about why do you think this lack of compassion exists in these types of moments?
We have an American culture that values being right above all else, that I am justified in whatever I do as long as I'm right.
Yeah.
It's also very Christian.
And it's also very Christian in a lot of Christian streams. Mm-hmm. Not all Christian streams, but in a lot of Christian streams. And it's not necessarily biblical, as the Bible does point it to say, hey, knowledge puffs up. So you got to be careful with that. We also have a severe lack of humility when it comes to how much we're actually right and how much we're actually wrong. And it's really difficult for a lot of people to admit that they're wrong. Because of that, we've replaced compassion with being right. That I can be mean and I can be condescending and I can be whatever is necessary as long as it's true.
Yeah.
And compassion is looked at as a weakness in our society in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And what's grieving to me is that when you look at the book of Matthew in the chapter 6, where it's really this Sermon on the Mount moment where Jesus is talking about what is in the kingdom, what the kingdom of God looks like, compassion is laced throughout everything that is going on. And being right is not found anywhere in that. And we have made such an idol out of rightness that we've lost compassion. And I think it also reveals the problems with a lot of our own personal theologies.
Yeah.
Where, and I have said this to a lot of people, and I will continue to say it till I'm blue in the face and dead and gone, and that is, if our theology doesn't lead us to be more compassionate, it doesn't lead us to have the fruits of the Spirit, then we need to look at our theology.
Yeah.
Because we need to have compassion for one another. Jesus treated people with compassion. And those he didn't show a ton of compassion for are actually more like the four of us. They're the Pharisees. They're the church workers. They're the pastors of their time, where he did not have a lot of patience for religious leaders who are using faith as a way to oppress the people.
Yeah.
And there needs to be compassion. We need to love people well.
Yeah.
We're called to love God first and love people second, to love them as we love ourselves. And this compassion for one another is central to our theology.
It absolutely is. And I think, unfortunately, we have been discipled by a culture of arguing and trying to be right.
Yeah.
And even I think about some language that we use in Christian spaces. We talk about we need to stand up for Jesus, or we need to be bold for Jesus, which yes and amen to that. Oftentimes, the way I experience that, and I hope I'm wrong, is we need to win an argument.
Right.
We need to make people who would oppose God look bad. If you want to be bold for Jesus, forgive somebody. You want to be bold for Jesus, go give your money away to help somebody in need and don't tell anyone about it. You want to be bold for Jesus, patiently build a relationship with someone who's different than you and share the gospel with them.
Yeah.
Like, that is what it means to stand up for Jesus. It's not become this culture warrior who's shouting down people who disagree. And unfortunately, we just, you know, I alluded to this in the last segment. I think we live in a world where just examples of argumentativeness, examples of, well, if your pastor didn't say this, you better leave your, you know, I'm like, what are we doing here?
Right.
It is not Christ-like at all. And so my next question is, okay, we could rue on the problem all day long. How can the teachings of Jesus help us to be more compassionate in our disagreements with others?
For me, I believe that Jesus taught the principles of how to love while disagreeing vehemently.
Yeah.
And it's the idea of how he treated Judas, that nobody even had a clue, that he loved him so well, knowing full well the man was anti him. The man wanted his death. The man was willing to sell him out for cash, and he still loved him to the end and loved him deeply. And I think so, learning the discipline and the art of saying my love is not contingent upon our agreement.
Yeah.
It's contingent upon my Jesus and upon my integrity.
Yeah.
And therefore, I will love in the difficult spaces.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right.
I think as a practical matter, proximity is everything. And when we look at how Jesus lived, he was just with folks all the time and all kinds of folks. And I think that really helps, even in these moments. You know, I think a part of the reason that that I'm in the situation I'm in is because I have proximity to radically different kinds of people. Yeah. And so it gives you a compassion for them. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can them all day until them is your people. Right. And when them becomes your people, even accidentally, then it becomes a lot harder to broad brushstroke. It becomes a lot harder to make blanketed statements about people and even have blanketed beliefs. And at the bare minimum, it makes you pause. Yeah. Right. And say, well, wait a minute. I know somebody who's in that camp, whatever that camp is. Yep. And my experience with them is not this, or my experience with them, you know, it just does a different thing. And so my encouragement would be have as many conversations with as many people as you possibly can. And that is work. And I will tell you, it's exhausting. But it's one of the critical ways that we protect ourselves from becoming that thing.
I think a way to develop compassion is to self-reflect and say, what did I need when I was at my worst? When I was making the worst decisions and the things that I would be embarrassed to be judged by, the things that I would be incredibly ashamed of people talking about in my life, what did I need in that moment? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we don't necessarily need a whooping, Judah. Oftentimes we need.
I needed a whooping. You wasn't with me in elementary school.
Well, okay. Well, we'll let your mom deal with that. What we need is grace.
Yeah.
We need grace for one another to say, you know what? I don't agree with them in this decision or in this perspective, but I love them as an individual.
Yeah.
And I love and want the best for them. And when I'm in my worst, when I have somebody who disagrees with me, what do I need from them?
Yeah.
I need to know that they love and care for me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need everybody to agree with me.
Yeah.
Most people won't. But I think we all need that safety of compassion and that safety of grace, because when we are at our worst, that's when we need others to be at their best.
And so much is possible if there's relational safety and compassion, and so little is if there's not. And I think to comment on something you said, Judah, relationships are so important because the way the algorithm works is it's going to show you the worst of the other side.
Yes.
So all of a sudden, you learn about, you know, what a conservative is like from what your liberal algorithm is showing you. It's going to show you the craziest examples.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you go, oh, well, they're all like that. Now, I think another element of this that's really important is, Lance, you and I are similar in this, and that is that if our families get together, and I don't mean our families get together with each other.
No.
Like, my family gets together at, you know, mom and dad's house for dinner. There are multiple, very distinct worldviews present. Like, I'm a Christian pastor who's very skeptical of partisan politics. My brother is an elected Republican representative. My dad is a liberal atheist. I've made the joke before that our family makes more sense if we were estranged. And we're not. And it's not weird. I don't go into family dinner going, oh man, if someone says something about immigration, people are going to start fighting. Like, it's not awkward. We ask each other about our jobs. We talk. We love each other. And I think that so much of social media and politics can lead us to believe that, like, we need to be, like, hashing out our differences all the time.
Right.
And I don't care. Like, even people, you know, people here at Bridgeway that I disagree with them on different things, I don't care. That is not the most important thing about them.
Right.
There's an opportunity to love and care for people if we can just get offline and actually, like, be mature humans. I think a lot is possible. That's not necessarily, like, I can't point you chapter and verse to that, although Jesus' disciples were certainly very diverse ideologically. But, man, I just think it's so important.
One thing that I just want to share before we close out, and that is, it's foolish to disagree if you do not understand what they're saying.
Totally.
And what I mean by, there's so much of this, I disagree with them, and you go, well, do you know what they were actually saying?
Yeah.
Well, no, but I disagree with them. And you go, well, that sounds foolish.
Or why they believe what they believe.
Yeah, and you go,
ask the question
and
why.
So at the heart of it should be understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what Pastor Judah was talking about was proximity helps with understanding.
Yeah.
It doesn't automatically demand it. You actually need to do it intentionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But having understanding allows you to even determine if there is a disagreement. There has been so many times that I have been in Q&A because I do a lot of what Charlie Kirk does. I do live Q&As. And when you do live Q&As, there's times when someone will bring something up and it'll sound like we start battling and we're actually in agreement the entire time.
Right.
We just didn't even know what we were arguing about. And so we were just misunderstanding. So my heart with everyone out there, please seek understanding.
Yeah. And on that note, just what is the church's role in times like this? We have had this horrific, tragic act of violence. It has reminded us of how divided we are as a world. How can we as the church be part of the solution in such a rough, rough cultural moment?
We need to seek unity, just flat out. The world will tell us that we have to pick a side, and we don't need to pick a side. There's no side to pick. It's the only side is really what is Jesus asking us to do, and that's to love one another and to come together.
Yeah.
And that looks so foreign and weird to the world around us that actually is a testimony into itself.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Lance, what would you add?
And I think that when there's an extreme event, it calls for extreme responses of Christ-likeness. So, for example, there are times when things go on in society and it's okay for the church to continue on with their debate. And then there's times when we see in the writings of Paul, he would talk about a specific context, like with Titus, we've been studying, and he's like, hey, there's been enough argument, there's been enough battles, we need to calm it down, we need tenderness, we need to be sweet with each other, we got to mellow out.
Yeah.
And that is going to shine more in our culture, that now is not the time to fight, because the whole world's fighting around us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you go, listen, we may disagree on this, and we can talk about it a little bit later. Right now, I'm going to find my commonality with you. I'm going to lock in with Jesus, and I'm going to keep the main thing the main thing.
And unity is really about recognizing there is truly so much more we have in common than the things that would divide us. But also, unity is not necessary when there's uniformity. So unity can exist when there is incredible amounts of diversity.
Yes.
And it's not sweeping things under the rug. It's not devaluing certain perspectives.
It's a deeper core.
It's a deeper core of going, yeah, we actually don't agree on this. But we agree on something far deeper, which is our love for the Lord. And that's where I just think the church fracturing over stuff like this, people leaving churches over stuff like this, just reflects something that I believe really grieves the heart of God. And as we wrap up, just continuing to mourn this awful, awful tragedy where an image bearer of God, a husband, a father, and obviously a very important figure, Charlie Kirk, was tragically killed. I want to close with actually a quote from him that I believe is wise counsel this day and every day, and I hope that we can live by it as we move forward. He once said this. He says, when things are moving very fast and people are losing their minds, it's important to stay grounded. Turn off your phone, read scripture, spend time with friends. As I said, that's wise counsel. I encourage you to continue to pray for the Kirk family, for all of those who are affected by his tragic death. And might we be people who show the love of Christ, particularly towards those who might think differently than us during these times. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.